Speaker will be Julius Lehner from the University of Texas at Austin. So he is now postdoc. He received his PhD with Jeff Winokur at the University of Pittsburgh, and he'll be talking about astrophysical applications of numerical relativity.
Okay, let me first say that my talk is going to be rather technical, not because I'm going to concentrate too much on the details, but I'm going to be using this gadget here. Yeah. Yeah, so anything can happen. This is the first time I'm doing this. So let me argue during my talk about numerical relativity indeed being able to provide simulations that are going to be astrophysically relevant. Although there is a long way for us to go yet, still, but there are things that are speaking very positively about the field. Well, today is the last day of this Congress, and it's actually very nice to be able to make a connection with some talks that were given on the first day. Let me talk about the string connection of numerical relativity. So I'm going to show that. Yeah, so instead of brains, here we have branches. And this basically is how I see the field trying to evolve. We're all picking some branch and fighting with the problems we have in mind. And eventually, probably, there's going to be one single method that's the right one, and we'll all agree that that's the one that we want to use. But at present, it's not really clear. All the methods have places where they are the best in that particular situation, and they are not really well suited for others. So the most used method is what I would call the 3+1 branch, which is basically just what Richard Price talked on the first day, and today Pablo also mentioned a bit, where you just slice your space-time with a sequence of hyperbolic or space-like surfaces. So, and there we either have the standard ADM, we have some hyperbolic or well-posed methods, and we have some that are just flux conservative, and they are all being widely used. We also have the characteristic formulation, which I'm going to talk a bit about it because it's one of the least known. And we also have the conformal field equation developed by Helmut Friedrich, which are also well posed.
They should have some black color as well.
Yeah, well, that's, I'm going to say, this is like in the string talk, this is very much connected to that, etc. So that's basically what I'm going to be talking. So I came up with this acronym to basically describe this thing, so the WWW, and don't worry, I won't claim I invented the internet by just coming up with that acronym. So the characteristic formulation is basically being used and developed at Pitt, Southampton, UNISA, Boston, Penn State, and Texas. And the nicest thing it has is that the outer boundary is placed at null infinity, and that gives us two advantages. One is that it let us not have reflections from the boundary, and therefore we don't have the outer boundary problem that Paolo was mentioning this morning. Since you have access to Sky Plus, you can actually give the waveforms in a rigorous wave. It's a very nicely adapted to wave propagations because you're slicing your spacetime with the surface that are characteristics. It has a very simple initial value problem formulation. You basically have to satisfy no constraints there. But if you have caustics or crossover, you cannot use this formulation. Then you have the 3+1, which is the most widely used, as I said. The best thing it has is there's lots of experience in that problem. You have absolutely no problem with the caustics. Rays can cross, but you still can deal with them. Some of them are well posed, but as a drawback, it has a very costly initial value problem. You have a set of elliptic equations that are really costly when you try to solve them numerically. And you do have the outer boundary problem, as Paolo mentioned this morning. On the other hand, you also have the conformal field equations, which are really nice because they are well posed. You have no caustic problems. You have no outer boundary problem. In fact, you have access to Scry and beyond that, and it can also give the weights rigorously, but as a drawback, it has too many variables. So although there are 3+1 implementations in 3D, they cannot resolve, they cannot put it in the computer with as good resolution as this method can. But it's a very appealing method. And so as I said, here we actually want to, maybe some connections of this method will give us the right one. One that was proposed is the so-called Cauchy characteristic matching, while in which you add these two in where they can help you the most. You use a 3+1 formulation in the interior, and you use a characteristic formulation on the exterior, and with that you can remove that outer boundary that the, that the 3+1 formulation had, and have access to Scry. It's not working as well as we would like to, but it's been shown to work in 1D and some easy problems in 3D. Just briefly to mention what the characteristic formulation looks like, and mostly because Roberto will be talking about it. If you foliate your spacetime with a sequence of null hypersurfaces, and you choose an area coordinate along the outgoing null rays, and you label each outgoing null ray by this these two numbers, and you have U as a, let's say, a time variable, then the metric can be written that way, and you have six equations, basically. So you have four equations that are just basically ODEs on each null hypersurface, and two equations which are the only evolution equations that you have to deal with. And this is very closely related to a wave equation, and there are many nice things that you could do with that, and that's why it's very well adapted to waves propagating in space-time.
Is the cylinder a time lock or is it not?
The cylinder can be, and thanks for that question, the cylinder can be time-like or null, and we'll heavily use a null inner boundary for the problems I'm going to be talking about later. So now, and let me talk a bit about American implementation, and I'll show you the 50,000 line code we have. No, actually, I'm just going to mention some details. So first, it's a 3D implementation. It's a very cheap one because we have very few variables. We can calculate the forms, and as Paolo said this morning, we actually, in this case, went and tailored a numerical implementation, a numerical algorithm, in order to solve that evolution equation that turns out that works pretty nicely. It can be second order or all the way to first order if we want to include some dissipation to deal with highly nonlinear problems. And I would say the testing stage of that code is already finished. We've tested linear space-time with linear waves, scattering of gravitational waves on black holes, spinning holes, single black holes with some gravitational radiation, etc. And it's fully ready for production. So if you now want to use the code for something useful, well, you have to provide initial data and boundary data. So if you do that, and suppose you had the boundary data on a time-like or null inner boundary that actually corresponds to the collision of these two holes, you could grab this code and give the waveforms for LIGO, turn off the light and just go home, because we don't need to get to do anything else. But our statement is rather dull, because we know that the boundary data is where the physics is, and in numerical relativity is where your nightmares are. So we want to come out with a way to produce this initial boundary data so that this guy can produce the waveforms. And you can name him whatever you want, choose your favorite numerical relativist and just name that guy. I have my own paper, but I won't tell you. So about colliding black holes, that's the first part. But in the past, we had this collaboration of, I guess, eight universities led by Richard Matzner. And there we tried to solve the problem. We failed. But we learned much in that during that those years. In particular, we had a code using this formulation, the ADM formulation, and that's precisely the one we're using now. We extended it in a bit in order to allow for parallelism But it's basically, we are using exactly that code that was produced in the alliance. And we said, okay, let's see if we can collide codes. And this is our first attempt. And I think we've passed, not with an A grade, but with a decent grade, which and we provide, we produce the first, our first form problems, two black holes collided. So what we did, we grabbed two curved black holes, we put them 10m apart, and just boost them toward each other in order to produce a collision, a Gaussian collision. So these were our parameters. Mass one is the angular momentum parameter 0.5, and the boost we use is 0.5. We use a grid that went from minus 10 to 10 with 81 cube points, and this was the location of the holes. One key ingredient there was the fact that we had to find where the horizons were so that we could extract that from our computational domain and don't run into the singularity of our code because our code would break. Although, ideally, we would like for this run to have enough resolution to go from minus 20 to 20 with this many points. But we can actually do that. Now we have a parallel code where we just have to put this initial data and run it. This code was primarily developed in Penn State, and we all put some feedback in it. So the simulation was started with these two curved black holes, 10m apart. This is what the horizons look like using this level flow method developed by Peter Shoemaker as part of her PhD thesis. And we let that evolve, and we kept track of where the horizon was. And this is what it showed Monday. So at this time, you actually have two separate codes. If you let this level flow method continue, it will actually find one hole here and one hole there, and there is no single apparent horizon containing them. So as the simulation evolves, we found that at this time, you actually have a single apparent horizon with the two singularities starting there, and that's what you find at late time. So let me show you again that movie that I showed on Monday. And this is the GXX component of the metric. Oops, oh, I said it would be a problem. So here is the two curved holes, and that's how the evolution proceeds. So at some point, we switch to a single mask, and the code actually worked pretty well. And this is mostly noise. We can actually use the characteristic formulation that was matched to this ADM interior evolution to produce the waveforms. At this time, we actually have basically noise. We have to work out with this resolution. We could start at a later time, let the system relax, as Abhay was saying earlier today, and presumably we'll get the waveforms. But as I said, there's still much to do, but the current results are really promising. So let me switch gears and tell you about two other astrophysical applications that we can actually solve. And actually, we can do this in a fairly short time. This closely related to what Sasha talked about earlier and what Roberto will tell you in a minute. So as using that prescription, we came out with intrinsic data for a fission in white hole. And now you want to embed this fission in white hole into a 4D and the four-dimensional space-time. And what you have to do is, at some particular time, give the extrinsic curvature, and then you can use the two extra Einstein's equations on this surface, and you can evolve that extrinsic curvature forward to the future and backward to the past. And that's enough to provide boundary data for the characteristic code to work. So this is what we are doing at the moment, and Roberto will tell you about that. We foliate the exterior space-time to this white hole horizon with a sequence of null hypersurfaces. We let the code evolve, and we produce the waveforms. Now, if you time reverse the picture, those will have some relevance to the waveforms that will be produced in the head-on collision of two holes. But that's going to be the subject of Roberto's talk. And last, let me tell you about the fact that we can actually produce the waveforms for the problem of a neutron star colliding onto a black hole. So, but if you want to use this characteristic code to do that, you have to be sure that you won't have caustics, because if you do, then you cannot use the code. So if you want to be sure that that doesn't happen, you have to satisfy that upper condition. So suppose you have a neutron star with mass little m, radius r, that is at a distance this to some black hole that has mass, unitary mass. So if this condition is satisfied, then there won't be caustics, and in principle you could use the characteristic code. On the other hand, you want the star to remain a star and not be tidally disrupted. And for that to happen, you have to satisfy the Roche limit and this an air condition. So it turns out, luckily, that there is a window of parameters that will let you satisfy both conditions at the same time. And so we say, okay, let's try to use the characteristic code to solve that problem. And in order for that to happen, well, we first have to put the fluid equations into our code, because our code was a vacuum code. And we did that in a rather naive way. We just put the first thing there in order to see where it could work or not. Our implementation cannot handle shocks. And you know shocks will happen, but I'll tell you more about that in a minute. So we've set the inner boundary as being at the null boundary past white hole horizon of the Schwarzschild space-time. And that's what Abba was asking before. So in that case, we use with a null inner boundary. So the boundary data is trivial because we know the matter will never reach the r equal to m. And we just can prescribe the data read off from the Schwarzschild solution. And in order to provide initial data that actually mimics a neutron star, though, that's work that's still in progress, but that doesn't stop us from trying to see whether this works or not. So what we did is, on the first null hypersurface, we put some blob of matter there, and as a first try, we put a shell of matter with some small pressure. And this is the simulation we obtain. So here is r equal infinity. This inner black circle is r equal to m. And you see this shell imploding, collapsing onto the black hole, piling up at r equal to m. And that's what you know should happen in these coordinates. And the code worked pretty well. But now we want to see what happens with a non-spherical case. So we put a similar blob of matter there with little pressure on the z-axis and let it collapse onto the black hole. And this is the second simulation. So here, this boundary here corresponds to r equal infinity. This is r equal to m, and you can see that the matter collapses onto the black hole, and actually everything is well behaved. So in this case, you can actually calculate the waveforms, because as I said, the code is there, the model is there to produce the waveform for you, and this is what you get for the plus polarization mode of the radiation. So you have an initial burst of this thing colliding with the black hole, but as the matter goes around and piles on the horizon, it tries to go to a spheric configuration, and so the radiation goes to zero, and that's what you see there. So what are our future plans with that? Well, this we formulated this new project called GRACE, which is General Relativistic Astrophysics via Characteristic Evolution, and it's a collaboration of all these groups here. And there we plan to use the state-of-the-art shock capturing schemes to evolve the fluid equations and actually evolve this neutron star colliding through a black hole. The prospect of getting that to work in a short time, I would say, are really, really good. First of all, well, because of the name. I mean, with that name, God should help us. We need all the help we can get. Second, we, Philippos Papadopoulos and Tony Font, actually grabbed a 1D characteristic code, put this shock capturing scheme, and they got extremely good results. And they also did that with a 3D code on a fixed background, and they also got very extremely good results. We need to address initial data and fluid boundary data, but as I said, the results we've obtained so far are really encouraging. So let me conclude with some remarks. So despite what's been said and the slow progress that probably numerical relativity has had in the last few years, we are in the position in which we can start giving us or producing astrophysically relevant simulations. And we have started studying the black hole collision in the full problem using the ADM equation or 3 plus 1 formulation in the middle that's free of problem with caustics or all that. We can solve the general problem and use the matching in order to extract the waveforms. We can use the characteristic code by itself with the shock capturing schemes in order to treat the fluid right. And so we'll be able to produce the waveforms for the black hole neutron star collisions, and that's good because from Enos Flanagan's talk we heard that the likelihood of that happening is even 3 times better than the black hole collision. And as Roberto will talk in a minute, we'll be able to produce also the indirect waveforms for the black hole collision. There's still much work to be done, as Pablo stressed this morning. We must know how to deal with the gauge conditions, and by that I mean the labs and the shift that will do the best work for us. We also have to start addressing the post-Newtonian transition from this post-Newtonian first phase to that phase where we should be able to take over and run our simulation, and that also was stressed by Pablo. We have to work better in the matching. We're doing so. There are stability issues that need to be addressed. There are also some stability issues that need to be addressed in the ADM code, or maybe we find out that the ADM formulation is not the best one, but we'll use whatever is the best option out there. We have to use input from perturbative treatments, not only because eventually we want to give our simulation to them in order to keep going, but also by studying and seeing their results, maybe we'll be able to address this gauge conditions problem. And as I said, even if we're not growing as rapidly as before, I think that numerical relativity is growing strongly. So usually one tends to end on a high note. Let me do the opposite and end on a very low note. And that's because I'm really worried about losing my bet. So although we're growing strongly, we're losing people steadily to the industry. So that makes me wonder if two holes actually collide and nobody's there to help in detection, do they really collide? Thank you.
From the point of view of LIGO, this obviously is a very interesting approach because you're able to calculate the waveforms. But suppose that you talk to an astronomer and tells you, look, I mean, there's going to be new satellites, AXAF, that I'll be able to probe in the X-ray part, a few sources of radio away from the black hole. But your coordinates are artificially enhancing those profiles. I mean, those spikes that you have when matter comes in, will that prevent them from looking at what they're interested in, that is the fluid flows, not that much the gravitational radiation?
That I'm not sure. We are basically addressing the gravitational waves here. That's an interesting problem that we haven't even started talking about.
So the black hole neutron star collision will probably be the most important source for LIGO, and I was wondering how far away can the neutron star be for your characteristic?
Well, it has to do with that those
right.
conditions I put before. Whoops, I don't know. Forget about it. These two conditions have to be satisfied, and
right.
Given a specific neutron star, let's say you say, okay, I want this neutron star to have this particular radius, then I can tell you where
suppose a neutron star is about 10 kilometers in radius.
I'm very bad at numbers. We can sit down and do it.
All right. Well, the neutron star radius is 5 times its mass, and the black hole is 10 times the neutron star's mass.
I don't remember the numbers from the top of my head. We can do it in a minute if you want. But we do have that window where we can give some astrophysically relevant simulations. Although that window is not existent in the neutron star grand challenge problem. In particular, in one of the things that they could do when they have this code running is collide the neutron star or black hole of whatever parameters you want to give without the problem. I mean, there we have a much better shape. In principle, in practice, they still have to address the problem of a 3+1 code that works and the fluid equation that works. They haven't shown that these two things can be worked by separately. At least we have a backing code that is tremendously robust on all the tests we've done. So we are in a much better shape in that respect. Assuming there is something interesting in that window, we'll be able to produce something relevant in less than 2 years, that's for sure.
I'm amazed positively that you can do something, a binary collision in null coordinates. Can you summarize again why that is possible here, where it wasn't considered possible?
Say that again?
What in the situation makes it possible to do a binary collision problem in null coordinates?
Using only the characteristic formulation?
Yeah. I don't know much about it, but I thought always that was considered impossible, and therefore people had gone to the trouble of doing Cauchy characteristic matching.
Right. If you have these two holes separately and you want to solve the pre-merger phase up to whatever you want, that the characteristic formulation cannot do using present technology, because you will have all sorts of caustics. What we'll be able to do is the post-merger, as Roberto will talk in a minute. Once these two things, or think of what Sasha told, if you are solving this white hole problem, think that your inner boundary is a white hole that eventually fissions into two. When it's about to fission, you'll have caustics clearly form, and that the characteristic code will not be able to solve. So what you were planning to do is give some initial data, solve with this inner boundary as a white hole into the future, and stop when we see the first caustic, and then turn the picture upside down. But that's what Roberto's talk is about.
I think he's also raising the question that you have caustics when you have these two masses. Sorry. When you have this black hole and this neutron star.
No, he's talking about the black hole.
Talk about your transparency where you had the neutron star and the black hole over here.
Oh, okay. So if you have the black hole and the neutron star, and you satisfy these two limits, that caustics do not form. So as long as caustics do not form, you can use the characteristic code.
Can you comment again on the discretization of those limits?
Oh, one of the limits is basically the Lansing equation. So suppose you have two rays coming out of your inner wire tube, that is basically the past white hole horizon of Schwarzschild, and you have a neutron star here. So it has some gravitational mass there that makes these two rays converge, not at infinity, then the code cannot be used simply because you have a coordinate singularity there and simply it won't work. On the other, suppose that doesn't happen, so that the black hole is so much massive than the neutron star that these two rays will actually just hit on infinity. Then it might happen that it's so much massive than the neutron star that it completely destroyed the neutron star. And that's the R equation, that's the Roche limit. That you mean that this gravitating body will not tidally disrupt completely the neutron star before it crosses the horizon. So those are the two limits.
So what are typical separation mass ratio?
Oh, that's the same thing I have to work out. That's his question. But
or at least no five other formation. Or yeah. So if you have a huge black hole, you can start with
that. Well, yeah, but if you have a huge black hole, then you can probably, and a very small neutron star, then you'll probably be able to solve that problem with a perturbative approach, and it's going to be much, much cheaper.
Yeah,
Sure. Just do that.
But it's when you have a small black hole that you have type of disruption. The smaller the black hole, the more disruption.
Perhaps we.
Concern about the kind of disruption if there's still. I mean, that's not the costs, but the problem.
Right, but no. What I'm saying is, if we are going to be, if you want to consider a neutron star colliding onto a black hole, and you want to call that star for a while, then I just want the star to remain a star till it hits the horizon. Otherwise, it's going to be just some distribution of mass going on to collide.
Why is it limited? I mean, actually, that's one of the interesting calculations that people are doing to find number of angles. I mean,
the C-count, the degree, and the black hole. Sure, but then I won't call that the neutron star black hole problem. It's going to be sun mass accreting onto the black hole. Okay. It's just a semantic problem.
I hate to...
That doesn't impose a condition on the problems I can solve. I can still solve some blob of matter.
My point is that it's not a restriction.
No, it's not a restriction. I'm just saying
you. The cost is the one that's a restriction.
Right, that's the only restriction.
Okay, let's move on. We'll thank our speaker again.